Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, yes, this is Tom Latcham, and this is FUBAR Radio, the UK's home of ad-free, uncensored radio. And I'm joined, I'm glad to say, by journalist, writer and broadcaster Jonathan Maitland. Hello, Jonathan.
Good morning, Tom.
I'll be coming to you in a second. We are talking about the election, politics, 100 days to go until the next general election, and no one knows what's going to happen. Not even John Rentoul of the Independent, who's got things wrong many, many times in the past and says he's probably got this wrong too. We want to know who you're voting for. Give us a shout. You can contact us, latcham@fubarradio.com on email, or you can tweet us at FUBAR Radio, or directly at me, at the boy Latch, or you can call us 0330-223-0200, just like Jem did earlier. He's voting for the Greens. Who are you voting for? Also, when have you apologised and not meant it? We've all done it, particularly probably in relationships. Lance Armstrong said he's very sorry for what he did, but he'd do it again, so he's not sorry at all. When have you ever apologised and not meant it? Get in touch, email us latcham@fubarradio.com, tweet us at FUBAR Radio, or call us 0330-223-0200. And as I said, I'm joined by Jonathan Maitland. You probably know him for his work on Watchdog and Tonight. He's a consumer journalist, one of the top in the country. But there's much more to him than that, because he's also written 5 books, I believe. He's part-funded and starred in a hit movie, 4 Lions, the Chris Morris movie about suicide bombers. It's brilliant, brilliant. It gets better as time goes on, as with all of Chris Morris's stuff.
Yes, it's got a long tail. I remember saying to him when he suggested to me at a cricket match that I might want to put money into it. He's not the kind of person who takes you to a cricket match so you'll put money in his venture.
No.
He's a lovely bloke, and he said, "I'm doing this film. You might want to put money into it." And the moment he told me about it, I said, "Oh, that'll have a long tail, and that'll get better over time." And absolutely, I always think it'll be the withnail and eye of its day, because there's so much truth involved in that movie. I've watched panoramas and pretentious kind of 2-hour Channel 4 documentaries about Al-Qaeda and read articles, but I've got more truth and more knowledge about what Al-Qaeda and terrorism is about from that movie than any documentary. Having said that, a lot of people, talking to a friend the other day, and he said that he didn't like it because it showed the terrorist as kind of somehow cuddly and likeable. So what's the answer to that?
Well, we were talking, I was talking to Caroline just before, because we were talking about a social worker who gave some of the children in her care cocaine. And I said, one of the underreported things that happened with the Paris terrorist atrocity recently was that all of them had been in care. And actually, it's not about them being radicalised and then suddenly turning evil. It's about them being disenfranchised and actually quite sad, lonely figures who've been through a lot of, a lot of bad times, a lot of, pass between care. And actually what they're looking for is belonging. And so in the same way with 4 Lions, you've got these, for want of a better phrase, lovable idiots who don't have anything in their life, and they're looking for an answer. And the answer happens to be found in in this extremism.
Sure. And that's undeniable. But the problem that my mate had with it, and that a lot of people have with it, and that I'm just looking for the answer to, is contained in that phrase you just said, lovable idiots. They're not lovable, they kill people. And I think seeing the film, you end up kind of rooting for them. And there's no element in the film of, hold on a minute, these guys are murderers. I mean, they're misguided, but I don't know how you do that. And I think Chris would probably say, look, it's a comedy, and by laughing at them, you kind of, You're making a point, but I don't know how you pull off that trick of making something funny but also getting across the point that they're murderous terrorists.
Do you think that was a negative in the film? I mean, obviously you really just funded it and you started very, very briefly starred in it. Do you think that actually watching it back, that's something you wish you'd done better, or it had been done better as part of it?
No, it's his thing, and he's not the sort of person. Well, no, he takes advice from a lot of people. I read the script beforehand. And funnily enough, when you read, I mean, I'm sure we'll come onto this later with plays and stuff, but when you read a film script and you're not very tutored in it, it's very difficult to get an idea of what it's going to be like. So when I read the script for 4 Lions, I thought, I'm not quite making sense of this, but I know it's Chris, so I know it'll be good. And when I saw it, funnily enough, the first time I saw it, I thought, wow, that's quite a piece of work. I think I like it. Fourth or fifth time, I thought it's fantastic. It's a fantastic piece of work. I'm just musing. I had no impact on it whatsoever. And if I'd said to him, you know, you need to make the terrorists more hateful because after all they're killers, he would have come up with a zinger and put me in my place, I'm sure, because he tends to be very dismissive. And he's very uncompromising in his work, and he will argue till the cows come home that something's funny.
Well,
even
I mean,
if it isn't.
As I say, it felt before its time in a way, in the same way that Nathan Barley. If you were watching that and you didn't live in London, you'd probably go, I don't really get this. I don't understand what it is. But now you've got people opening cereal cafes in Brick Lane.
Well, good for them. And your colleagues from... Actually, you know, they're not our colleagues from Channel 4 News going along and trying to do an arsey, clever interview. You know, I mean, wankers from Channel 4 News trying to slag off guys who are trying to make a decent living and charging £3 for a bowl of cereal and saying, you know, who can afford it? Well, it's like... The people who can afford it can afford it. And why, as the guy said, why are you having a go at me running a cereal cafe when you should be having a go at the usual suspects?
Well, you're in Tower Hamlets, which houses, of course, the banking sector of the UK, where people are on, you know, millions pounds, you know, multi-million pound salaries for effectively, you know, doing a for banking. And these guys are setting up a very small business. But they may be morons. I mean, they might be idiots, but the fact that they're...
Well, they're trying to make a decent wage. And that's the sort of thing that really annoys me about Guardian stroke Channel 4 type journalism. Of course, they have right on their side a lot of the time. But, you know, to do that, it's just so misguided. But, I mean, to get back to Chris, yes, That's the thing. I mean, his point is, and he's absolutely right, the one thing that they tell you you can't or shouldn't do is, of course, the one thing you should be doing. And if they're saying to you, you shouldn't be doing a comedy or something that's funny about terrorism, you know, that to him, that's like a red rag to a bull. And I remember reading the other day somebody was slagging off a comedy that was in questionable taste, saying, God, it's like making a comedy about the Nazis. To which I would say, well, yeah, one of the funniest comedies of all time was about the Nazis, which was The Producers, you know, in Springtime for Hitler. And that's what Chris was doing, admittedly, you know, right in the middle of it. I mean, Springtime for Hitler was 20 years after, you know, World War II ended. Mm. Chris did this right in the middle of it. His brother once said to me, the thing I really admire about Chris is his integrity. And at first I thought that was a slightly kind of limp compliment, but as time's gone on, I realised, you know, he's absolutely right. You know, he has unimpeachable integrity. He's very brave, and you know, he won't let anybody tell him what to do. And he is fantastic.
Well, I read a book about him, and I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, it's called Lucian Randall wrote it. I helped him with it. Yeah. It's called. It's a good book though.
You can't remember the name.
No, it's called. I tell you what, it's called something like Sodding Genius or something.
Well, I read it over Christmas, and you are in the book. You work together at Radio Bristol, and his not being told what to do is a theme that runs throughout the entire book. And I found it really, really fascinating. You became friends at BBC Bristol. How did that come about? And you must be fairly close now.
We're good chums, but I like him very much, and I get a very good Christmas card from him every year, and I about once a month I say let's meet up, and he can't because he's so busy, but we'll sort it soon. And we met because I suppose we're kindred spirits, really. I mean, we both liked comedy and music and being rebellious, and really the thing about Chris is he's a fantastic journalist, but his jumping off point to deal with all the knowledge that he had was comedy and satire, and my jumping off point was current affairs. So I had considered a career in what he was doing before we'd got to Radio Bristol, and I just thought, rightly, I think there's more money and more stability in being a journalist and a writer and doing current affairs and news, as opposed to what Chris is doing, because you know Chris would have had years where he couldn't rub, you know, two pennies together, because he's brilliant, he's made a good living out of it, and that's fantastic. So we kind of briefly came together and actually did we used to write funny songs and sketches, and I'd do impressions of famous people on his show, and we even did a comedy pilot for Radio 1 called Week In, Week Out, it was fairly embarrassing, but, you know, it's me trying to be like slightly a dumb kids, you know, like I'm trying to be funny. I mean, you know, I had and have a fair bit of comic invention, but I couldn't keep up with him. Although our common ground was we used to ring up papers and sell them stories and put on silly voices and make money like that. And then I wrote a song about bovine spongiform encephalopathy, what you need is a frontal lobotomy. That was the opening line. And Chris put it to music, and we got on radio, we got on Pick of the Week on Radio 4. So we really hit it off. He's a fantastic bloke. And but then
is there a part of you at all that, obviously you chose the path of money and stability, as you just said, but is there a part of you that seen how well he's done and thought, oh, I could have just been his sort of sidekick, we could have done some great amazing stuff together. For me, he's a legend, and I don't have even a scintilla of his talent as far as comedy goes.
It's interesting with Chris, because for every person who thinks he's fantastic, there's somebody who hasn't heard of him or thinks he's appalling or overrated. I think he's fantastic, even his stuff that I don't like. But it's amazing how people like you absolutely worship him. And there are a lot of people out there who do. No, I never thought that, because I didn't have the guts to do what he did. And I would have flickered briefly for a bit and kind of, you know, got in something mainstream and made a lot of money over a short period of time, and then died and been a bitter and twisted ex-comedian, of which there are
many. Like all of them.
Yeah. As opposed to Chris, who just kept on going. I remember ringing him in the mid-90s and saying, hey, I could do a sketch for On the Hour. And he goes, it's all right, Johnny, we've got this kind of thing. He kind of just gently batted me away. But I... funny if that's what I feel I'm doing now. I mean, the thing is, in terms of, I mean, God, you know, Chris is an artist and he's fantastic. But I just wanted to kind of be, big part of me wanted to be recognised and kind of famous. And I got reasonably famous in the early 2000s because I was on a programme called House of Horrors, which was about dodgy builders. And it got nominated for a BAFTA and it got 10 million viewers. And it kind of started all those Big Brother type programmes and those building programmes. And I get a lot of people coming up to me and going, you're that bloke, oh, I like your pro, I like that, you know. And it's, you know, it's a very low-level, Z-list level of fame. But I like that. I like that. And what I'm doing now is, in a very mainstream way, actually, making up for all those years when people like Chris and other friends of mine were working in showbiz, and I was loosely termed it showbiz. I'm sure Chris wouldn't say he works in showbiz, but making up for the times when I turn on the telly or go and see a film or a play and think, God, that shit. And I'm not saying I'm better than that, but surely I'm not going to be worse than that David Hare play or whatever it is that
you've got a low sort of benchmark then for how good your stuff you want your stuff to be.
I'm worried. I don't want to get above myself and think that I'm better than a lot of the crap I see, but I just honestly think I couldn't be worse, because there's so much, you know, shite out there.
Well, the reason you're here to talk to us is that you've written a play. He's turned his hand to the theatre. There's nothing else that he can do now. You know, you've done books, you've done TV. Now, why not tackle theatre? Mm-hmm. And you've written a play called Dead Sheep. It's about the famous Jeffrey Howe speech, which led to Margaret Thatcher's downfall in the early 90s. And it's being staged at the Park Theatre in London from April the 1st, 2015, for 6 weeks. We'll talk about that just after this song. But if you want to talk to us about anything, obviously this is going to be a slightly political next section. It's 100 days to go to the general election. It's neck and neck in the polls. We want to know if you're a swing voter or you've decided to vote, you've decided to vote for.
Have you decided not? I mean, there's this Russell Brand business. I mean, poor bloke. I mean, I know he gets the piss ripped out of him and he does talk an incredible amount of balls, but he is onto something about not voting. And he got slanged off by Nick Robinson, the BBC political correspondent, for saying don't vote. I actually think it can be a very intelligent, good-for-democracy decision to not vote, actually. It's something we might talk about.
Well, I haven't voted, and we can talk about that in a little while for the last few general elections, and I'll explain why. But if you want to get in touch about that, email us, latcham@foobarradio.com, or tweet us @foobarradio, or call us 0330-223-0200. Also, if you've ever apologised and not meant it, in light of Lance Armstrong's non-apology about doing steroids, get in touch again, latcham@foobarradio.com, tweet us @foobarradio, or call us 0330-223-0200. In a kind of Desert Island Discs type way, I'm asking everyone who comes in what songs they want to play, and, you know, hopefully you'll get a nice variation. We've had Caroline Kent's favourite stuff, so if you could play a song right now, we'll play it for you. What would it be?
In me?
Yeah.
I would say my favourite song of all time is Tempted by Squeeze.
We'll play that, and we'll be back to talk about Johnny Maitland's new play, Dead Sheep, right after Tempted by Squeeze. FUBAR Radio. Yes, this is FUBAR Radio. I'm Tom Latcham. This is the UK's home of uncensored radio, which is why Jonathan Maitland, who's my guest, swore a little bit earlier, and we didn't say anything. We didn't stop him, because it's fine.
Well, what I'm fascinated by this concept of uncensored. I mean, so what word, do you have a checklist of Anglo-Saxon that you're allowed to say and you're not?
No. You can say whatever you like. I mean, obviously, you know, we're still governed by the laws of the UK, so you can't come on here and libel somebody. But, you know, given that you're a journalist of some repute and experience, you probably wouldn't do that anyway. But no, you can pretty much, so long as it's the law of the land, freedom of speech rules here on FUBAR Radio. You can say what you like.
Interesting.
And we do. So you, going back to what we were saying just before that song, which was wicked, a really great song, love it. One of your favourites too. You've written a play, you've decided to turn your hands to theatre, and you've written a play called Dead Sheep, which is about the Jeffrey Howe speech which led to Margaret Thatcher's downfall, and it's being staged at the Park Theatre in London from April the 1st for 6 weeks. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'd seen a lot of Margaret Thatcher type dramas. I'm sure we all have. There was a very good Lindsay Duncan one on BBC Four a few years back. There was The Iron Lady, of course. There was a play called Handbagged, which was on at the Tricycle in Kilburn and then went into the West End. And they all had a lot to recommend them in one way or another, but they all, I thought, missed the best story because they all treated Jeffrey Howe, who was her Deputy Prime Minister and one-time Foreign Secretary and Chancellor, as a kind of treacherous buffoon. I mean, in The Iron Lady, for example, the actor playing him, John Sessions, he's a very good actor, you know, nothing to play with, really. Just he was portrayed as a bit shifty-eyed and a bit treasonous and actually a bit stupid. I mean, Jeffrey Howe was an amazing politician, and I thought the amazing story was, hold on, you know, we're talking about story arcs. Everyone talks about story arcs. You've got a guy who's gone from her best mate politically to stabbing her in the back and the front, number one. Number two, you've got a guy who can't speak without sending everyone to sleep. That's why he was called a dead sheep. His opposite number, Dennis Healy, said being attacked by Jeffrey Howe is like being savaged by a dead sheep. Hence the dead sheep of the title. So you've got a guy who's going from the worst speaker in the world to making one of the great political speeches of the 20th century. That's a hell of a journey, as they say. And thirdly, and the icing on the cake for me, was the fact that Geoffrey's wife, Elspeth, really didn't like Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher really didn't like Elspeth. Elspeth was a witty feminist. Margaret wasn't witty and wasn't a feminist. So they really got on each other's nerves, and they were described by one onlooker as being like wasps in a jam jar. Whenever they got together, they'd be buzzing and fizzing and fighting. And I thought, you know, I know that these years, this period in history has been written about generally, but this is a fantastic story of guts and honour and integrity and your wife hating your boss and your boss hating your wife and being uncharismatic but being a fantastic politician and a thwarted ambition and jealousy and conniving. It's fantastic. And I thought, if I don't write it, someone else will. So I wrote it, and all these years, as you were talking earlier on about, am I jealous of showbiz pals who've gone into showbiz? The good thing about not going into showbiz, one uses the term very broadly, for 30 years is that, you know, you can kind of, you've got that thinking time, 30 years to work out how you write, what you want to write about, to get better at it. So when you finally come around to doing it, hopefully you're not making the kind of mistakes you would have made in your 20s and 30s.
And why would you say people should come and see it? I mean, a lot of people who come and see it won't have been around at that time. What makes it relevant for today and for those people?
Good question. Number one, I think people of your generation, Tom, you're 20 years younger than me, you're all fascinated with Margaret Thatcher, aren't you? Still. And, you know, you hear your parents talking about her and you hear people saying she was fantastic, or more likely, you know, I hated her guts. And this, I think, gives a new into Margaret Thatcher, what made her tick, why she fell from power. I mean, it's always fascinating the kind of when you look at why really, really, really powerful, successful people fall off their stool. And you'll remember when she died, you know, there were people going around singing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. And there was a huge amount of interest in her then, and I'm hoping to kind of capitalise stroke exploit that.
Did you go to her funeral procession?
No. I watched it on telly a bit. And also because I think it's with luck, it's that word resonate. I think there's an amazing, we all want our politics to be better and to be more honourable. And Jeffrey was an amazingly honourable person because he basically threw away what was left of the rest of his career and had a lot of people hate him by standing up in Parliament and saying, this is what I think. I wish Mrs. Thatcher would stop slagging off Europe. he said it a lot more eloquently than I'm saying it. He made this amazing speech, and everyone, a lot of people hated him for it, and she was gone a few days later. And we bemoan the lack of honour in politics these days, and so I've written a play that says, actually, you know, you can have honour in politics, and this is what it looks like. Also, fun enough, the big key issue that brought her down and made him make his speech was Europe. And, you know, it was then and it is now. So there's a lot of resonance. Also, Mrs. Thatcher's being played by a man, a guy called Steve Nallen, who was the voice of her in Spitting Image. So it's actually a great comedy turn as well. So there's a little bit for everybody in there.
Mm. And do you, obviously, Margaret Thatcher's dead, but Geoffrey Howe isn't. And have you worked with him at all? Does he know you're doing it?
Yeah, I went to see him in the House of Lords. It's fair to say he... you know, he's in the autumn of his years, so and he never really understood it when people did plays and films back in the day, just after Margaret Thatcher had gone. He used to criticise the films and said it wasn't a bit like that. He talks about this. They got everything wrong. So he kind of had he had problems getting his head around exactly what I was wanting to do, but he was very helpful, and he gave me the names of a lot of people who were very helpful in the project.
Do you think he'll come and see it?
Probably not, but if it does well, I suspect his wife might. But she's never... It'd be a great bit of PR for us, you know.
Well, you'd definitely get in the Londoner's Diary in the Evening Standard.
If Elspeth came to see the play about her, because she's never, ever spoken publicly about what she thought about Margaret and about those turbulent times ever.
Do you think she might? I'm wondering here as a freelance journalist whether there might be some money in it for me if I go along and talk to her ahead of the play coming out.
Yeah.
She might do.
It would be a great story.
Why don't you do it?
I think you have to be careful with... I mean, as you know, very good PR ideas can be an unexploded bomb, and they can kind of make your product into something that it's not. So, you know, the kind of PR you... I think people smell a rat, and if you do too much PR and get stories like that there in advance, it's like, is this guy a journalist who's trying to sell stories, or is it a good play, or what? I mean, I went to see this play, Truth Lies Diana, recently, which was written by a guy who... specialised in pantomimes, actually, and he got amazing amount of publicity for it.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a fairly easy sell, really.
Yeah, you know, with James Hewitt saying that his relationship with Diana started a year before Harry was born, so that was all over the papers, and then more stuff about, you know, slightly unthought through conspiracy theory rubbish. And I just think, I mean, it wasn't a bad play, actually. I mean, it was thought provoking, and it tried really hard to entertain. But I think that kind of publicity can just rebound on you sometimes. I don't know.
And what are your hopes from the play, or for the play? Sorry.
I think of little else these days. I mean, I still.
Well, how long have you been writing it for? I mean, that's not a surprise.
No,
is
I
it?
Wrote it very quickly.
Oh, right.
I finished it in May, and we had a deal to stage it a few weeks later. So there's an appetite for it, I hope, and I think. And I still, you know, present the Tonight programme on ITV, which is ITV's, inverted commas, flagship current affairs show. But I've been doing it for 15 years, and I think, you know, some of the stories are repeating themselves. My hope for it...
I know the feeling, given that I worked in newspapers for a long time, and that was kind of why I like doing radio in a way, because you get to create, in the same way that you're discussing now about your play, you get to create something new every week. Whereas when you are writing for a newspaper, for instance, as with the, you know, your Tonight programme, things repeat themselves, you're kind of in the same stories, sometimes with just different characters. So I quite like that idea of the creation, you know, the creative side of it.
Well, also, TV is very limiting creatively. I kidded myself that I was working in a creative industry, but it isn't very creative, actually, because you're hamstrung by the facts, you're hamstrung by the pictures, you can only write kind of captions to the pictures, so you're not really exercising your writing capabilities at all. And I suddenly found, God, writing a play, it was like you're in the sunlit uplands of semi-fiction, and it's wonderful. You can, you know, really stretch your legs. And what I hope for it is that people enjoy it, that it gets good reviews, that it sells out, and it goes to the West End. That's what I want, but whether it'll happen...
Quite clear aims. And some performances are going to be followed by a special Dead Sheep election debate, which is a 45-minute Q&A sponsored by the Electoral Reform Society, and they'll feature a panel of politicians, writers and entertainers. Who are they going to be, and why are you doing that?
I'm doing that because we want to sell tickets for those hard to...
And there was me thinking you were going to be some Russell Brand, Firebrand, or Rick Edwards, or whatever, keen to get people voting.
I can make it up, but I mean, matinees are hard to sell tickets for. Matinees are hard to sell tickets.
You're nothing
for.
If not honest, Johnny.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but matinees, the evening performances have been selling very well, but the matinees haven't, so we'll have those debates and get some students in because it'll be good for their A-levels and or what they're called these days. Who will we get in? My comedian mates like Alistair McGowan and Ronnie Ancona, who care about politics in a very... and Richard Herring actually used to present on this
show. He did, indeed.
I haven't asked him yet, but... You know,
he'll come.
All these people, you know, I know through TV, get my BBC and ITV mates to...
Chris? Get Chris Morris to come? Do you think he'd come and do it?
God.
Oh, come on, that would be...
I'll ask him.
You would sell that out in an instant.
Yeah, but the reason we'd sell it out is because he never does those things.
Quite.
So I'm not going to waste the cost of an email. might get his brother, actually, Tom. Tom is a... runs the Bristol Old Vic and is now an associate director of the National Theatre, and actually told me that I should write my play about Geoffrey Howe. And Tom's got some interesting thoughts. But, you know, Chris has no... I remember calling out 20 years ago and saying, you know, there's an advert going and you could earn 100 grand out of it. And he said, I just don't do that. I just don't do that. And then he told me he used to wake up in the middle of the night sweating because he'd, you know, had to feed his family and he'd just turned down loads of money. But... you know, he's for real. He really is for real. And, I mean, look, you know, don't ask, don't get. But, I mean, I know what he did. He just sent back a one-word piss-take response. but there are plenty. I mean, I've got lots of friends from the BBC and ITV who'll, what's it called? Invigilate. What do you call it when you're the invigilator or the configurator? The masturbator. The guy.
Not this, not that. It's definitely
not that. It's the guy who... the guy who...
well, like Dimbleby.
It. Yeah.
I don't know.
It ends in ater, anyway. Yeah. It's not alligator. But anyway.
Adjudicator.
Adjudicator!
By the way, I'm not going to claim that one. It was shouted in my ear by Adam, the producer. Well done, mate. Congratulations.
So now I've got...
he's got a vocabulary.
So yeah, we'll get writers, comedians and BBC types to invigilate or adjudicate. Actually, I'm not sure it's adjudicate because that means that you judge. So, but anyway, one thing we won't have, I think, is politicians because...
really?
Yeah, they're always, you know, they want to score party points and stuff. And actually, if you talk around the subject, it's probably more entertaining. So, you know, like political editors like Dave Wooding from The Sun on Sunday, he's really good.
And yeah, yeah, he's
Elizabeth
excellent.
Elizabeth Day from The Observer, who's a good friend of mine.
John Rentall, he's just been on the show, he's excellent.
Some people
he's
like that,
he's
exactly.
A good one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's Dead Sheep, and if you want to see that, you should go and get tickets. I'm definitely going to go. That's being staged at the Park Theatre in London from April the 1st, 2015, for 6 weeks. We're going to play another song now, and we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about journalism, because you've been in journalism for quite a long time. I obviously have been in journalism for not quite so long, but enough time. Been through a bit. Given I was lost my job in the News of the World Shut. So we'll be back to talk about that. But we want to hear from you about anything we're talking about, frankly, today. A bit of politics, 100 days to go to the general election. Who are you going to vote for, if you're going to vote? One of you apologised and not really meant it, just like Lance Armstrong apologising but not really meaning it for taking steroids. Get in touch, Latcham at foobarradio.com on the email, or tweet us at foobarradio, or me directly at the boy Latch. Or you can call us 0330 223 0200. That's 0330 223 0200. As I said, I'm with Jonathan Maitland, who's the journalist, playwright now. What song would you like to hear next?
Well, I always thought that the most joyous bit of pop music that's ever been written or performed is I Want You Back by the Jackson 5. And actually, there's a very good version by Graham Parker on The Rumour, which is... almost as good, but this is probably the best bit of pop music I think that's ever been committed to vinyl.
Well, it's a good job you didn't want that one, because we've only got the original. But here it is. This is I Want You Back by the Jackson 5. We'll be right back with Jonathan Maitland right after this.
Tom Latcham on FIBA Radio.
Hello, welcome back. I am Tom Latcham, and I am joined still by Johnny Maitland, who is a writer, broadcaster, general media man, does everything. Now written a play, Dead Sheep, about the downfall of Margaret Thatcher.
And let me ask you a question, Tom. So we were talking earlier on about News of the World and stuff.
Right.
I mean, it was interesting that because the News of the World were closed down and became, I mean, I suppose in many circles were regarded as pariahs. I mean, are you ashamed or embarrassed about having worked for them? And how do you feel about having worked for kind of a paper that was closed down because of the appalling behaviour of its journalists?
Absolutely not ashamed. I didn't do anything wrong. I was merely a casualty. I joined in 2008 when I thought that I was told it was a changed paper, and actually the reality is it was. It had changed in terms of its criminality.
It changed in terms of the people that it was listening to. Whose answer phone messages it was listening to, but it was still it was still ruining people's lives.
But in 2008, it wasn't carrying out criminal acts, which it had previously done. And I joined a paper that I was told was a changed paper. You know, I'm still not going to pretend that it was all fairies and gold dust. It wasn't. It was grim. It was a toxic place to work. But you don't realise it until you leave. Mm. I went out for a drink the other day with my old former boss, Jules Stenson, and I hope he won't mind me repeating this, but I don't think he will. He's very remorseful for the way he acted. He was a very hard taskmaster.
Acted in terms of towards the workforce or the people whose lives he ruined, or both.
Both, I think.
That's really interesting.
And he is. He's pleaded guilty recently to phone hacking charges, and he faces sentencing in the summer. Yeah. He's very, very remorseful and very sorry about the way he treated us. And I said to him, Jules, I don't blame you. That place brought out the worst in people. And there's a story, you know, there's personal stories across this. And for me, what I said to him was, you made me a better journalist, right? You taught me to be a proper journalist. I wasn't getting that tuition before I joined you. I was a trainee at the Mirror Group before that, and I was headhunted at the end of my trainee scheme to come and be the feature writer, and within sort of 18 months I was TV editor and whatever at the age of 28. He did that to me. Yes, he was could be very difficult to work for. He was bullying, but he was a bully across the board. He wasn't
he was an equal opportunities abuser.
He was indeed. And he's very ashamed. And I said, it brought out the worst in all of us. I mean, when the paper shut, I didn't realise the paper shuts and you're like, oh, so this is what life's meant to be like. It's not meant to be completely relentless, where you're booking a holiday once every 6 weeks so you can just get rid of the hecticness of your life, where it's relentless and it never finishes, you're never switched off. And my parents said to me, they said, we've got our son back.
Well, do you know what's interesting is, I don't know if you or Jules, or I know you weren't involved in phone hacking, so that's fine, but with people like Jules saying, if he says, I regretted treating you, Tom, badly, great. If he's saying, I regretted phone hacking... Phone hacking was never a big deal for me or for most of the population, as you know. It's not that bad. It's the electronic equivalent of listening to someone's phone conversation in the pub. What was bad was the culture where you had people like Mazam, what's his name?
Mazam Mood,
you know, just ruining people's lives on the basis of made-up evidence often. Or, you know, exposing people because it's prurient and because they like sex, which has no bearing whatsoever on their ability to do their job, and there's no public interest whatsoever. And I'm pleased that the culture seems to have rode back a little bit from that. But, you know, I think those journalists who paid public officials and listened in on phone conversations shouldn't be upset that they did that. What they should be upset about is the stories that they printed, like the Max Mosley thing. You know, trying to ruin the guy's life just because he liked to have a bit of a party in a dungeon. I mean, how is that remotely in the public interest?
With that story... So I don't think it's that they've set out to ruin someone's life. You're given a story and you're like, that's a belter. And, you know, now you wouldn't do it because of privacy laws, which he, by the way, forced through Europe, which is, you know, incredible determination.
I'm not saying it's your fault for doing that story. The fault lies with the culture and the head of the organisation for thinking that's a story in the first place and for doing it.
Well, I've
because you're just ruining people's lives and bringing upset and carnage and emotional distress to people who do not deserve it. If you want to expose Max Mosley, get him for being corrupt with his dealings with Formula One or whatever, but not because he likes being whipped by a tart in a dungeon, because that is nobody's business own.
Well, and now we wouldn't do stories like that. I say we, I'm not in newspapers anymore, but newspapers wouldn't do stories like that. The privacy laws are such that actually you need a very good, strong public interest defence. And if you read a story about sex now, say the Ryan Giggs one where he cheated on his wife with his brother's missus, the whole piece was weird. It was like you read it and it was like six pars of sort of like, this is what he did, and then just the entire rest of the piece was just like, he's an ambassador for UNICEF, he does this, he does that, trying to basically show we've got a public interest defence for running this, which I don't think they actually did, frankly. I think that he's never used his family for financial gain or anything like that, so you're not exposing him for being a charlatan in that walk of life. There really wasn't a public interest defence, but that's why now those stories have to have a public interest defence, which is why you see far fewer of them. The what you need to get is much higher. The standard is much higher now. So, you know, there was an era where we lost our way.
There are no new laws, though. You're saying there's a privacy.
No, there are. There are.
What are they?
European law.
Where did that come out?
It's Article 8, the right to a private life.
Yeah, which previously wasn't invoked.
Well, effectively as well. So, well, and effectively, yeah. It's embarrassing to break that law because it goes through a court and, yeah. and you're ashamed and you're shamed in that regard.
Yeah. And it costs.
It's also, well, the cost is kind of, so there's a story that I'll tell you about, which I broke, which yeah. was Peter Crouch sleeping with a teenage prostitute when he was with Abby Clancy. As far as I could see, there wasn't a, I mean, I got the tip. And I didn't do the work on it. I just had the tip. I had to go on holiday, so I couldn't do the entire story. But we worked on it for 2-3 weeks, following him around Spain or whatever. Got him doing it. I knew he'd done it before. He did it again. So basically, going through that story, there was no public interest defence. This was a man who had never spoken really about Abby Clancy. And so the discussion was, as far as I understand it, although I wasn't party to this discussion, was he ain't going to sue us because it's true. But he could get us on privacy. How much is it going to cost? 50 grand. Okay, we'll do it. And then there's a limit of 60 grand. So actually, if you think that a story is big enough, you might suck it up and go, well, actually, we'll just do that story. But it's embarrassing now, particularly in the era of post-Leveson, where you know newspapers are being looked at for how they behave. Yep. To be dragged through the European courts by somebody suing you over privacy doesn't look great.
Well, that's why we should thank The Guardian for exposing phone hacking, albeit on the basis of a wrong fact, which was, you know, I took
Nick Davis on Sky News on
did
that
you?
Point. Yeah,
and was he repentant for getting his facts wrong?
Not whatsoever. Yeah. Which is funny, really, because he's such an egotist. He couldn't handle the fact that. Well, I damned him with faint praise because what I said was, you know, you wrote that, and it's true. He wrote this story saying that they'd made a mistake that the News of the World hadn't deleted emails, voicemails from Millie Dowder investigation, which was. Claim, which basically was partly the reason we were shut down. I think it probably would have gone anyway, but that's by the by. But at the time, you think that is a major part of it. They then admitted that there was no evidence that had been the case and rode back on it.
Yeah. So to put it in simple language, basically, Nick Davis, who broke the phone hacking story, his central fact about what News of the World is alleged to have done was wrong.
Was wrong. And he kind of mealy-mouthed admitted it on a page 10 that broke on a Friday night that was when the EU was sort of, the European single currency was going a bit going a bit tits up. And he sort of buried it on a page 10, left-hander. You know, they're the ones that are saying, wow, you should do a front pager, you should be pushing front page apologies if you libel someone. Yeah. But when they got it wrong, they hid it on a left-hand page, page 10, Friday night. And I went on air and I said, no one noticed it over the weekend, but the News of the World together on Twitter kicked it into the news agenda and it was leading Sky. Good. My tweets were all over Sky. And then they rang me up going, do you want to come on and talk to Nick Davis? And I thought, oh, fuck's sake. I thought, I should do, because I've been talking about it on Twitter. I should have I should back up what I'm saying. So I went on, I took him on, and I said to him, I said, Nick, it was so badly written, it was clear as muck, and I find it difficult to think that you and his colleague, I forget his name, David Lee, I think it was, who between them have 60 years of journalistic experience, won loads of journalistic awards. I said, I find it hard to believe that, you know, two great journalists like you who've won, you know, a plethora of awards could write a story quite so badly that my dad, who's a Guardian reader of 30 years, knows the story inside out because of me. He couldn't understand what you were saying in the story, and he didn't really know what to say. So I got in, gave him some digs, got out again. They asked me to go on Newsnight. I said, no, you're right, I've done my thing.
Mate,
so instead Jules went on. And Jules, Nick Davis had
obliterated him.
It was like car crash telly, and I was like, thank God I didn't do that.
Well, there's two really interesting things. Number one, I still thank The Guardian for what they did, because they made you and your colleagues row back from doing stories that ruin people's lives and have no public interest defence. I know why you did your stories about Peter Crouch, because you're young and you want to make a living and you'll do anything. I'd have done that if I'd gone down a certain path. I don't blame you at all for that. Secondly, what's interesting about Nick Davis, you know who he reminds me of, bringing this conversation back full circle, is Chris Morris, actually. He's
really
a kind of jihadi, extreme, kind of Shiite Christian. He's so very moral and single-minded. Mm. And I realised, I did a Radio 4 profile of Nick Davis. It's a 15-minute programme when he was doing the phone hacking stuff, and you basically do a kind of, it's like the radio equivalent of a newspaper profile. Mm. And he's so uncompromising and so determined and so obsessed and has such attention to detail and is basically an interesting, attractive guy. I thought, my God, that's exactly like Chris. They're like, but one's gone down the satire route, one's gone down the current affairs.
I think my problem with Nick Davis is not that he uncovered the story, which was an incredible story and deserved to be told in its full. I mean, my argument is the News of the World should have told that story themselves and said, look, we've got rid of everyone who committed an illegal act here. They are gone. This is the story. This is what we did. We're very, very sorry.
But that story in itself, you know, what is good about it is that single story, even though he got it wrong, and it was probably a lie, was responsible for substantially changing the culture of the tabloids.
But it's also brought about Leveson, which has now irrevocably damaged all newspapers. You know, it's not.
It depends which side of the fence you're on. How has it damaged them?
Because they can't. They're no longer able to. I know there are public interest stories that are now spiking because they're like, can't do that. It's got, like, for instance, the Sun.
Very much done
the
that.
Sun
Give me
stuff.
An
the, well, I can't because it's inside the paper. But people have told
no, Tom,
me who work
if
at the Sun.
It's in the public interest, then they probably could.
No, because it's got to go through New York. They're all terrified. They're just dropping stuff. They're like, I won't touch that story because it's just too risky. And if you're a journalist,
you'll end up in private eye. And it'll
but
get
also,
out
if you're a journalist and you're working for a company like News International, who has handed over its journalists and its sources, and you're thinking that's slightly risky. It's a whistleblower. That's slightly risky. A, you're not going to write it. B, the whistleblower isn't going to come to you. It's damaged newspapers because people are terrified now of having their sources turned over. And why would you bother? It's just a job now, particularly if your job, your bosses are going to put you in prison.
Sure, okay. I understand that the Sun and the News of the World or the Sun on Sunday have been cowed by that kind of thing. But News International is still doing amazing stories. The Andrew Norfolk stuff on child abuse in Rotherham, still got that through. And I think while the pendulum has probably swung too far, and one or two of your colleagues are probably thinking, I'm not going near that, the fact is, if they cared, and if the story was that much in the public interest, they could get it out. And also, they would just do their informants a favour and say, listen, mate, this is a really important story. Go to Private Eye.
Well, to talk
go to the Daily Mail.
To talk about you.
Go
about,
to the Times.
To come back to yourself, you obviously are the presenter. You've done Watchdog. You then did Tonight, which is a current affairs programme.
Yeah, on ITV.
Obviously, you are governed by Ofcom in a way that newspapers aren't. And now that Leveson, they want to bring in this sort of statutory underpinning in the same way as Ofcom is underpins TV journalism. Yeah. Do you find it difficult, given that you're underpinned, not underpinned, you are governed by Ofcom, to get... to get tricky stories over the line?
Well, do you know, I mean, people say to me, you said very kindly earlier on that I was a journalist of some repute. I'm not. I almost embarrassed to be called a journalist. You were and are much more of a journalist than I ever was. And the reason for that is Ofcom. It's just absurd. It's like having a boxing match with two hands tied behind your back. Ofcom is so limiting. In terms of, for instance, doorsteps. If you want to go up and doorstep somebody on a current affairs programme, you can't. I wanted to doorstep a troll who was making someone's life a misery. We couldn't go within a million miles of him because...
Well, then if you do, then they kill themselves and you end up as like Martin Brunt from Sky News, pilloried himself.
That's a problem. But you have to give them advance warning and then they just get rid of you and give you a lawyer's letter and you can't. The lawyers are so worried about breaching the Ofcom code because it's so expensive. We are completely got two hands tied up behind our back. I really kind of envy people like yourselves who have worked or do work in the less regulated journalistic sector. The trouble is, we are overregulated and you guys are underregulated. It's still, I mean, even before Leveson, it was like the Wild West. You guys wrote pretty much what you liked about who you liked a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Now it's still pretty much underregulated. And you've got this thing about I always call it statutory underwiring, like a bra. Statutory underpinning. I don't know why you're so upset.
Supporting tits.
I don't know why you're so upset about having a little bit of legislation that just basically shows everyone that you're serious. You know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of statutory underwiring, if you ask me. But anyway, the point is, it's really impossible to do proper crusading, interesting journalism on TV in a way that you're doing here with FUBAR Radio. And actually, the future of visual journalism might well be a kind of FUBAR setup when you actually go up to somebody who's a bit dodgy and just stick a camera in their face and make them publicly accountable. It'd be a lot more exciting and get a lot more viewers.
We should team up. We could team up. We could team up this show with your show, and we're not. We can run all the nasty bits that you can't, because you're carried by Ofcom, and we're not. We can do what we like. You can do the sanitised version on ITV, and they go. And if you really want to see the dirty old version, which we couldn't get past the Ofcom regulators or the lawyers, you can listen to it on FUBAR Radio. We're not scared. It's a good idea. That
Letcham and Maitland, we're coming after you. But you have the consumer journalists, don't you? Like in the Daily Mirror. Penman and Summerlad were good, but God, TV is just so overregulated and lawyers crawl over everything and it's a pain in the arse.
So does that make it So there's not the exposure that should be. I mean, to be fair, there have been some brilliant ones recently. You know, the care home stuff that was on Channel 4. And, I mean, a friend of mine, Paul McNamara, and Guy Basner at Open World News did one about hospitals incinerating dead babies. I think they were nominated for awards. Still, you do get some good
stuff
on
TV. The bar
is
a lot higher with TV, and maybe it needs to be because TV is so influential. What you can do with newspapers, though, is take a punt and, like you said, print a story. If not about Peter Crouch, say about a hospital behaving dodgily. Mm. And it can be, I think with papers, it can be pretty much right, and it can be there or thereabouts, and you can print it and you're okay. Mm. With TV, that's not good enough. Mm. You need visual proof, and it needs to be 120%.
Interesting stuff. Johnny Maitland, it's been lovely to have you in the studio talking about your play, which is Dead Sheep. As I say, it's being staged at the Park Theatre in London from April the 1st for 2015 for 6 weeks. Where can people buy tickets?
Just Google Park Theatre Dead Sheep and you can buy tickets, and they're quite cheap. I mean, it's Dead Sheep, it's called the play, but the tickets are dead cheap.
Oh, very good. Have you done that before?
No, it's the first time.
Might do it again, though. That's Johnny Maitland. He's also a consumer journalist and general media man, and fascinating. It's been really lovely to have you in.
I've enjoyed it, thank you.
We're going to be playing out a recorded interview I did with Johnny Vegas. He's going to talk about his career and his new healthy lifestyle. I mean, he's still pretty big, but he's drinking less, which is good. So he's going to tell us about that and how he's sort of not, perhaps not even having to get drunk to go on stage, and he's doing his... He's doing it as Michael Pennington rather than Johnny Vegas, who's a sort of alter ego.
What's he doing these days? Because he wasn't a bad. He'd kind of be quite. He was like a good Falstaff, wasn't he, or something?
Yeah, well, he was in. He's in Benidorm, but he wants to get into production, and he's going to talk about that as well afterwards, and his sort of what he plans to do in the coming years. And yeah, he started gigging as Michael Pennington rather than Johnny Vegas, who he says he had to create to get over the crippling nerves that he had to go on stage. It was an alter ego, and it goes back to an attempted abuse on him at school. So it's really interesting. It's a great interview. So stick around. We'll be playing that out right after this. But we want to hear from you. Get into touch with us. We're talking politics, 100 days of the general election. Labour and Tories are neck and neck. We want to know who you're going to vote for. Is it going to be UKIP? Is it going to be the Greens, like Jem was saying earlier? Get in touch with us, latcham@foobarradio.com, or tweet us @foobarradio, or me direct @theboylatch, or you can call us 0330 223 0200, like Jem did earlier. That's 0330 223 0200. We've had a message come in from Alex. He says,
wow,
alright.
Somebody is out there.
We've got messages. We've had a few today, Johnny. We've had a few.
Hold on, the intern on the show is called Alex. Are you sure it's not from him?
That cannot be verified at this current moment. Alex says, you mentioned Russell Brand and not voting can be powerful. 2010's voter turnout was 65.1%. That's a lot of non-voters. What percentage would be required to be powerful? There's already an awful lot of voter disillusion. Do you see the solution as engagement or as an advocate of electoral reform anyway, a revolution?
Well, a revolution is a bit sick form and it's not going to happen. But in terms of electoral reform, what I would like to see is, number one, the boundaries changed because they're very unfair at the moment. You can have a constituency where you have 10,000 people return one MP, and then another constituency with 100,000 people and they return one MP. I'd also like to change the voting system. I mean, proportional representation is massively and self-evidently much more fair than the first-past-the-post system we have at the moment. But there was a referendum on that and it got unbelievably voted down.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was saying, you know, we mentioned a little bit earlier, I said I'd talk about how I hadn't voted recently. I've always lived in very heavy Labour areas. First it was Bethnal Green and Bow.
And you strike me as a Tory.
Do I? Mm. Oh, no, I'm quite left-wing.
Are you?
Yeah. None of them represent me. That's what I'll say. I'm probably more of a socialist. I'm an old Labour supporter. That was what I would say. But... it was very heavy Labour there. Then I moved and it was Shabwell and it was Respect, and I didn't want to vote for George Galloway because I don't like him. I don't think he's a nice person. I don't think he's a nice politician. He's an excellent politician, but I don't think he's a nice one.
He's a fantastic speaker.
Yes. And then moved now to Hackney, where Diane Abbott is. So again, 17,000 majority. There's literally no point in voting for anybody else, maybe the Greens or whatever. It's just no point. And people say, oh, well, you know, you should vote for them because it says something, but it doesn't. You should spoil your ballot. No, that looks like a mistake. What I'd like is, and this is what we had Rick Edwards on the show a while ago, who's very much talking about youth political engagement. He's fantastic.
He's very handsome.
Get him on. In fact, actually, I'll put you in touch because he would be a fantastic person for your debates, and he'd be brilliant. We had him on the show. He does like young question time, effectively.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah.
And so he's all about sort of like getting first term voters to vote. He says we should bring in online voting because that's going to engage the
very
youth.
Good idea.
So actually, get him on your show. He'll be great for this matinee thing. And that's what I would like to see. I'd like to see none of the above, so I could go in and actually register a protest vote that wasn't. I might vote this election. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, in Australia, they have compulsory voting, and therefore, if you do have compulsory voting, then you have a box saying none of the above.
Yes.
And that's interesting. Fun enough, if you had proportional representation, then people would feel their vote counted for much more, and you would get a lot more breakaway parties, like, say, an old harder left party, an old socialist workers party type thing. We'd probably get quite a few votes. People who are pissed off with Labour for not being left-wing enough, and obviously pissed off with the Tories, although actually Labour are becoming more left-wing. They're talking about partial renationalisation of the railways,
the problem is,
and a higher minimum wage.
But
they're sounding a bit more lefty.
Yeah, but the problem is, with one pass the post, they're only ever going to be fighting over 40 constituencies, all of which are Middle England, and so actually although they're talking hard, there's no real benefit in going to the left, because actually you're fighting over the very middle ground.
Yeah.
So it's difficult.
Well, change the voting system, but you know, that ship has sailed, so
quite
tough luck.
So we're basically, there's nothing we can do about it. There's no point in voting. Nothing's happening. What do you think? Get in touch with us. latcham@foobarradio.com on the email. Tweet us at foobarradio, or at me at the boy latch, or call 0330 223 0200. Also, when have you apologised and not meant it? Like Lance Armstrong. Get in touch. latcham@foobarradio.com. Tweet us at foobarradio. Johnny Maitland, it's been lovely to have you. Thanks very much. Go and see Dead Sheep, everybody, because it's going to be brilliant in April. Starts in April at the Park Theatre. And your final song, if you could have one?
My final song, if I could have one. There's two songs called... Well, there's a lot of songs called Rock and Roll. They're my two favourite songs called Rock and Roll. One's by Led Zeppelin, which starts off with the most almighty, God-given riff from Jimmy Page. And the other one is a much more sexy, kind of offbeat, extraordinary-sounding thing from The Velvet Underground from 67, which is kind of, it's like kind of sexy rock, pop, jazz. It's just the most extraordinary sound. And it's so, you listen to it and you think, God, that's why, this is how music changes people's lives, because it's so thoughtful and sexy and intuitive, and it's about the power of rock and roll to change people's lives. And it's got such a different sound, and it's got that incredible thing that all amazing music has, which is it's utterly timeless. It's utterly timeless. It's clearly born from the 60s, but if you heard it tomorrow, you'd think, wow. And I don't know if other people...
Well, we're going to hear it now.
Yeah, do you know which song I'm talking about?
What?
This one.
Rock and Roll by the Velvet Underground. Well, don't bother anyway, whatever. Johnny Maitland, thanks for coming, mate. Dead Sheep is out soon. Here's this song. We'll be back.